Good afternoon. We will continue our journey together. Why am I speaking of foundations before speaking of intimacy with God? One of the reasons is I've been teaching on this subject the last 4 years on different continents in quite a few countries, and I have noticed one thing. As long as I don't present a deeper framework for why do we need intimacy with God, I see that most people will keep functioning the way they function, often with this cultural element number one, and will try to add some of intimacy with a technique of discernment which is on this side. As soon as we don't get accurate data through our intimacy with God, like if intimacy with God was about getting data, we discard and we go to the next thing. Intimacy with God is not an add-on, it's the core of our faith. Jesus would say, "Remain in me as I remain in you. Without me, you cannot do anything." And we clever people say, "Oh, Jesus, we do a lot of stuff. Once in a while, give us a hand. Because, you know, with grandma, I'm struggling." Which means, with all the other relationships, no problem. I'm in control. Except for grandma today. Really? I have to dig a little bit more this afternoon on why a change is needed. And for that, I need to go with a critical eye on our culture. You know that Europeans, who have been great to help other people in the world realize they needed to do changes. We went to Africa saying these poor savages needed to change their culture to welcome Jesus. We forgot just a small thing in the process. We have often been uncritical of our own culture. We do see that Christianity is dying in Europe and that we are struggling. But we have to ask the questions. What is at stake? Is there a poison that we give with the milk, that we communicate so that people cannot develop a strong faith? Is there something in our culture which is impacting the fact and leading to the fact that our communities are dying, that our churches are struggling to grow? I do believe there is something. Do I have the complete answer? Of course not. Let me try to explain to you behind this thing what happened in, let's say, since the middle of the Middle Ages, how we moved always more toward control, and how this control shifted from the magisterium of the church to the magisterium of the scientific community, and how in the shift God was not the Lord, neither before nor after. So let's go back together. I invite you to go back to the beginning of universities. We are in the 11th, 12th, 13th century. I bring you back to a place I know well, the Sorbonne in Paris. You have two theologians, two great minds, Thomas Aquinas and Bonaventure. Aquinas is a Dominican. The Dominicans, they are teachers. Let me tell you, if you don't know who are the teachers in the Catholic Church, you will have two who will be fighting, the Dominicans and the Jesuits. They are spending 7 to 9 years of full studies before they become Dominicans or Jesuits, okay? We, the pastors, the Protestants, we are kids in comparison with them. Many have PhDs and all that. Bonaventure is a Franciscan. The Franciscan, they are more on the prayer side, on action. Action. Than on the teaching side. Dominicans do have a practical element, but they are more on the intellectual direction. And they have a debate. They have a debate about whether humanity has been completely damaged by sin or not. Thomas Aquinas will hold the position which will become normative for most of Christianity after that. He will say, consciously or unconsciously, he will say, humanity has been completely damaged by sin, except one part. Do you know what part has not been damaged? Reason. Reason has not been damaged. Here, he's taking Aquinas is in a time where they begin to recover the philosophers of the Greek philosophers through the Arabs. So he reads Aristotle through an Arabic translation into Latin, and he begins to argue that reason is not damaged. Bonaventure says no. Every area is damaged. This is the beginning of a journey which will lead us in some of the most extraordinary discoveries of science and in some of the deepest stupidities of our modern culture. Two sides. After Aquinas, we will have this move always more toward reason, step by step. You will have Renaissance, you go 15th, 16th century, you begin to have the implementation of this reason and rational view of reality as an object beginning to impact different areas. In Renaissance, you have the beginning of the discovery that there are different cultures. When you read the Gospels, when you hear about stories of far in the past, it's not like today. Before Renaissance, if you see a painting, the guards of Jesus at the tomb are almost always clothed with the clothes of the day when they painted. After Renaissance, they try to paint with the idea they have of the clothes of a Roman soldier, for instance, which will increase with the time, with historical research and discoveries. So they begin to realize difference. It's the learning of the perspective. The perspective was in painting. In Renaissance, they realize that there is a distance that you have to represent, and you have tricks and ways when you paint to show three dimensions with a dot and you trace lines. And as you paint, it helps people to see a three-dimensional object. In the historical domain, it means you begin to explain that the stories of Jesus are from a distant past. They are not close to you. It has a double inheritance. One, a blessed awareness of historical context. That I love. The second, a cursed split between the life of Jesus and my life. Which means people will begin to say, you cannot imagine you're with Jesus when you read the Gospels. In the time of Jesus, when people would hear stories, oh, by the way to communicate relational knowledge is through stories. The way to communicate objective knowledge is through rules. In scriptures, what do we have? Some on this side and some on this side. In Proverbs, it's kind of rules. What to do for getting best results. The law of Moses. And at the same time, you have stories. It's two ways to communicate two different types of knowledge. When people in the time of Jesus would hear a story, the best we can understand, we would say they were pre-modern or even way before the pre-modern, they would imagine themselves the stories. If I go today to Africa and I tell a story of a lion, when I tell the story, the kids, what do? They scream. Why? Because they see the lion. And the power of stories is you have an inner representation of what is shared with you. So you become participant of the story, and the story is more than just a limitation to two or three rules that you want to implement. It becomes real. And the story enables you to implement in your life in ways which will be different with each person. In some ways, the story is richer than a rule. When Jesus was asked, who is your neighbor? He could have said, oh, anyone. It can even be a Samaritan. That would have been an objective knowledge answer. But he went for the relational one. And through that, he taught way more than just left or right. He taught how to have an encounter with God, with the God who teaches us through stories often. Through the Renaissance, it's the beginning of the loss of relational knowledge as valued by authorities. And as we shift toward this direction of objective knowledge, we will have a shift of power. Do you know what was the queen of sciences in the 13th century? If I would ask, what was the queen of sciences? Theology. Do you know when there is a change about who is the queen of science? It's in the 19th century, so I will fast forward a little bit. We will have the change through discoveries with science. You will have Reformation. Reformation is a change of magisterium, authority. We shift from tradition, with the Pope and the bishops and everything, fighting with the king. By the way, you had always, in Germany, you had some kings who were not that happy that the Pope wanted to be the number one. But one of them, of your emperors in Germany, ended up on his knees at Canossa, begging for the whole night in the snow, because the Pope wanted to remind him who is the boss here, with the whole theory of the two swords and all that business. It's a matter of power. The power will begin to shift through the Reformation toward scriptures, more than toward human authority. With Luther, that's a key shift. But it's a first shift. We are in the 16th century here. We move toward the 17th and 18th. You have a new shift of magisterium, authority. And this shift will be toward science. You go to the 17th century, you have Isaac Newton, who discovers something amazing, that mathematics can help describe reality and predict what will happen. Amazing. The law of gravitation, when you think about it, it's amazing that you can describe with equations how something falls. And Newton was a theologian more than a scientist. Let's be honest, his theories on the Trinity were not that that balanced. I'm not sure I would follow where he was heading. But he wrote more on theology than on science. And his development of science was for one purpose, to show that we have a coherent God. But there is only one step between a coherent God and a rational God. And then you will have slowly the drift toward the idea that perhaps all the laws of the universe will allow you to predict anything. The door is opened by this law on gravity. Then you have Kepler, you have different ones, Maxwell, end of 19th century, moving in the direction of thinking you can control and know all what will happen. The power of the objective knowledge, people become aware of it. One of the practical consequences for Christianity, God begins to be cornered at best as creator, but he cannot be involved with his creation because he has, they believe in God. In the Enlightenment, they believe in God, in a God who created a world which is very coherent, And it's like a hide and seek game to discover all the laws so that we humans will be in control. And we will be able to predict everything. Beginning of 20th century, in Greenwich, you have even a research institute which has for task to predict the weather for the next 100 years. Do you know where is this research institute? Gone. So we have this move toward the power of reason, objective knowledge. For Christianity, it means it becomes cornered always more. Deism, we call that. You know deism? Deism means you believe in a God who created the world like a clockmaker. He started the clock, and then tick-tack, tick-tack, the clock runs. You just need to figure out where you are in the timing of the clock, and you will know what is the next step. Would it not be nice? In some ways, humans thought it would be nice. But this objective will come to an end. You have Albert Einstein, who, beginning of 20th century, is a rather good student in physics, and he wants to do research. He says he would like to do research in physics. His teachers say, no, don't go in physics. We have discovered almost everything. There is nothing more to discover, which is really interesting. Poor Albert. He will revolutionize with his discoveries relativity and open the door to quantum mechanics. For him, it became a curse because he was a deist. Albert Einstein believed in a God who has created a coherent world, and we are supposed to discover all the laws. His problem was, with quantum mechanics, you realize that you have no control. This comes to an end. Painful end for scientists. Basically, how did science function up to then? The more precise the measurement, the more easily you can predict what will happen. So, if you want to be able to predict further in the future, you make a more precise measurement now, which means no limits to your control on the future. What came with quantum mechanics? It's around 1910, the very beginnings up to 1930s, when you have the big discoveries. I like to say it's a little bit like a soap in the shower. The more you squeeze it to make sure it's at a specific position, the fastest it goes out of your hand wherever. I'm not sure if you have done some quantum mechanics experiments in the shower, but it's pretty convincing that we should be careful. In quantum terms, whatever the precision of the position of a particle, the more precise you get on a position, the less you have an idea of the speed of the particle. Basically, you have to choose. Either you have the position or the speed. You cannot have both. Well, I can tell you, Albert Einstein hated that. He hated it so much that he tried to bug his colleague Max Planck and figure out thought experiments to destroy quantum mechanics for 20 years. And Max Planck, Niels Bohr, I apologize, Niels Bohr. And Niels Bohr would have to pull his hairs to respond to Einstein. What is at stake? The philosophical background of science for most was still this deism. With the 1930s, this powerful objective knowledge comes to a limit. And then scientists begin to realize we don't have control on reality. It's horrible. Einstein, he got so angry, he still believed in God, but the clockmaker, okay? Not the God we believe in, but still he believed in a God who created the universe. And when he was discussing with his colleague Niels Bohr, he said, God does not play with dice. because it seemed like quantum mechanics says whatever can happen. So for Einstein, it's like dice. What he did not realize is it's not because he cannot know what will happen that nobody knows. It's not because I cannot know something that it's impossible to know. He understood that it was impossible to know with scientific methods, which means he was hitting a hard limit of science. Do you think scientists like that overall?
No.
So they began to add a layer to hide the many limits which began to come in physics, in meteorology, in different areas, could speak of evolution. They began to add probabilities to their equations. 19th century scientists would have bashed them saying, you're not scientific. Don't put probabilities, statistics in your equations. That's not scientific. A scientist is supposed to predict what will happen. If you cannot, shut up and say, I don't know. The problem with all of our human magisterium is always the same. Pride. Before the scientist became the official authority, it was the church. And of course, the church in the Middle Ages, there was no problem of pride, you know that. Yeah. It's always the same issue, pride. When you have one approach, and you begin your approach, is the perfect approach. Science is a wonderful and powerful tool, but a limited tool. And when you begin to add chance into your equations, either you do it with humility, saying, well, that's the best we can do with our theories. Here, I'm at peace with it. Or you have many scientists who say, it's the best we will ever be able to reach. Which means we are still in control. Nobody is better than us. Don't go to others. Let's still ask us to know what is the future. We are Madame Irma. In France, we call that Madame Irma. Madame Irma is the lady who has a glass ball and tells you the future. Okay? And I'm a scientist, understand me. So let me explain to you what happened. Science is based on experimentation, especially if we, let's say, speak of physics. Oh, by the way, the queen of science, it's a German who defined it in the 19th century. His name was Gauss. And he said, the queen of science is mathematics. Because mathematics is at the heart of physics and allows you to access the root of reality, basically. And to discover limits in science has done something very important. It has taught us, although some don't want to hear it, that mathematics combined with physics don't give us access to the root of reality. It gives us a model. It gives us a model, an imperfect model of reality. It's very important, this difference. A model, it's not the reality. Science thought you can access the root of all what is happening here. But what happens is you access only something at the surface. Rather deep, but at the surface. One of the most bothering results came also with Einstein, what is called the dualistic understanding of light. You have some people who will tell you, God, is he three or one? And then you say, try to explain, it's a mystery, he's really three, he is really one, and you try to find illustrations, and people say, oh, it's too complicated. I invite you to play a game with, if you have scientific friends, especially if they criticize faith as too complicated. Ask them, please, I have a hard time understanding light. Is light a particle or a wave? And then your friend will say, you know, it's very complex. In some cases, it behaves like a particle. In some cases, it behaves like a wave. and then play the game. Say, friend, either it's a particle or it's a wave. It cannot be both. Please, don't have fun with me. Are you a scientist or are you playing jokes with me? And push them. Put them in the trenches. And then you will say it's a mystery, ultimately. We don't understand. But it makes sense. It's how it behaves. It's how reality functions. Well, the question of mystery is the key. And when you're in the control mode, you don't like mystery. You want to get rid of it. As we move in relational knowledge, well, mystery is everywhere. In scriptures, it speaks of women. Well, you have no idea what is the journey of a man in the heart of a woman. You know that kind of stuff? Humans, we never know perfectly someone else. Relationships are not about control. It's about, if I use scientific terms, positive feedback loops. A positive feedback loop means I do something to someone else and I have a positive result. I interact with someone and overall, we both benefit of this interaction. In a couple, it can be one description of love where we desire to do good to the other, but we do hope the other does good to us. A certain form of harmony and love is what we are shooting for in relationships. So let's go back to our thing. Science has developed through experimentation, measures. By the way, the Greeks were really lousy with experimentation. They were always in big ideas. That's why they never developed a very good system of cosmology, of the move of the stars, the sun, etc. In Egypt, they were a little better with Ptolemy, who was kind of a little Greek. But the first one who develops a real experimental method will be Tycho Brahe, a Danish guy, very interesting character, who will measure precisely his whole life. He does not have the long view of Galileo yet. He will spend his whole life to create tables of the movement of the different planets in the sky at different moments. Very precise. His student is Kepler. Kepler will reap the data. We did not have Facebook. We had Tycho Brahe making the whole data of the movement of the stars and of the planets, and Kepler will be able to combine the result of Isaac Newton, the movement of gravitation, with the movement of planets in ellipses and no more circles, as people thought. So you have this experimental method which develops and which is very powerful. What is experimentation? You do something, you're not sure what it will come out. What you try is to do an experiment which has a maximum of chances to succeed. You don't just do stupid experiments. You do experiments with the hope to obtain a good result. When you do an experimentation, are you sure you will get a good result? If you would speak to a scientist who does an experimentation and you say, I will do the experimentation at only one condition, that I'm sure I get a good result. Do you think the guy will be happy with you? Why? What will he tell you? You don't know?
The result is.
You tell him you're a scientist? Will I get a good result or not? It's where we confuse God and science sometimes. Well, experimentation means you take risks. You always have a scientist with a black face who has something which exploded. You know this one. We try to have experimentations which avoid that. Perhaps you don't see how it relates to our whole business of intimacy with God. Hold on with me. Experimentation leads us to discover principles. And up to the 20th century, we thought that we would reach a point where the principles would rule. At the level of pure science, this movement, with the hopes it had, came to an end in the 1930s. If you want names, Niels Bohr with quantum mechanics, Kurt Gödel with logic, mathematical logic. That's the most painful one, because if in mathematics there are contradictions, then the whole system blows up and comes to a limit. It still remains useful, but no more perfect as people thought. Kurt Gödel explained how any logical system complex enough to have numbers, natural numbers, was either incomplete or contradictory. Isn't it embarrassing? Either it's incomplete, there is something true you cannot prove, or it's contradictory, you can prove that something is black and that it's white at the same time. That's not very good for a perfect system. So this came to an end in the 1930s. In the mindset of our cultures, we have not yet reached this limit. We still function with this paradigm of science getting to principles. You see it because there is a lot of... I'm sorry. As a Frenchman, I tend to be direct. There is a lot of stupid research in physics for the unified theories. Have you ever heard of people like that? Stephen Hawking and all the others trying to find the unified theory. What are they working on? With that, where they unify everything. Well, this died already in the 1930s. He has to read Kurt Gödel and he's done. I'm sorry. You see my French humility there? This died a long time ago. But in our culture, it's still there. Now, let's see how it plays out in Christianity, in our pastoral trainings, in our church functioning. Here is how our culture impacts us. In scriptures, you have, let's say, encounters. Relationships, experimental people meeting with God, with angels. You know that angels exist? Mm-hmm. You know?
Yes.
And that they speak to people, they speak to young girls, to we would have children. You know that kind of stuff, the crazy stuff that people don't believe today? When we believe that? It's definitely not on this side, my friends. Our scriptures are full of that, from beginning to end. They are about an intimate relationship with God, where they seek God, God seeks them, there are dialogues, there are consequences to this dialogue. God calms the sea, transforms countries, kills people, raises people from death, all that business. It starts with Adam and Eve in Genesis, the first chapters. It ends with Revelation at the end. Now let's see how the culture influences Christianity. Oh, you experiment and you draw principles. Well, we have a bunch of experiments in scriptures. Let us draw a systematic method to find the principles. Have you ever heard of systematic theology?
Yes.
That comes from this cultural influence. The Catholics, they use dogmatic theology. They are more at ease with this one. I'm not sure I would pick this one. Tom Noble is struggling with the title of his new theology. He definitely does not want to go for a systematic theology. He's, you know Tom Noble? In the UK, he's supposed to write our future authoritative theology that we have not had for a long time in the Nazarene Church, one where we could say, yes, our structure approves this theology. He is trying to work on the word integrative theology. That's the direction it seems he is taking. It's extremely good systematic theology. Extremely useful. But with one danger. You make of God an object. You make of God an object of study. So the whole purpose of scriptures is to pull out principles that you will teach to people, And you tell them, if you apply these principles, God will be happy. We could call that a clever legalism. Okay, we're very clever, so we have a clever legalism where we teach rules which are pulled out of scriptures. And understand me, I value very much scriptures. But they're not a book for only objective knowledge. When we do that, it's like if we say God has interacted with the world in the past, but no more today. You know, you have some people, fun stuff, you have some, they're called the cessationists. The cessationists, they are telling you, well, miracles, that was for one time to prepare for the revelation. Now we have the perfect revelation. For their stuff, they need to tell you that they have a perfect experimental foundation. If it's incomplete, it messes up the whole system. So the scriptures are perfect, absolute, and you have all what you need to find all the principles, and so on, and so on, and so on, and so on. Nazarenes were not very far from this position, but we make a slight difference. We say we have all what we need for salvation, for walking with God. It's a slight difference. We have been cautious on what we call inerrancy. You know this business? Because we don't see that these encounters are over. Science, I thought that principles would replace. And when you go to school, in general, you learn principles. Experimentation is very secondary in educating people. So you're trained to believe that the principles are the key. When you study physics, of course, you do one or two experiments to say that you have done some lab work, especially if you go to masters or PhDs, but quite a bit of the purpose is to get to the principles. Now let me be honest with you. Science has always been about experimentation. The principles are very useful because they allow to do better experimentation. They allow to be more guided in what you test. Instead of trying to throw an apple left and right to see how it falls, well, we have pretty much good ideas how it works. So we don't reinvent the wheel. We have principles, but these principles don't replace the need for experimentation. Which means we have to build feedback loops in all our scientific systems. Feedback loops, we are decide. Back and forth. One of the best illustrations is what is a smartphone. In the past, I spoke to you this morning of a defective anthropology, an incomplete or mistaken understanding of how humanity functions. Up to today with neurosciences, we begin to realize that pretending that we are rational beings only is just foolish. Reason played a key part for humans, but many more things, especially the relational element, plays a huge part. But when the people developed the first computers, what was the model they tried to imitate? They tried to imitate a human being. And they thought a human being is a rational being. So it's a being which has data, who processes the data, and does actions. How did you pick your meal today? How did you process your data when you saw the different things? The number of scoops you would take? Did you analyze well? What was the calorific needs of your body, the balance between proteins, glucides? By the way, there were not enough scientific details, so I hesitated to take most of the things we have today. We don't function in a rational way. Emotions play a part, relationships play a part. And scientists thought that's rubbish. What is really complex, what is at the heart of humanity, we can go back to Aquinas on this one. It's reason. So when they built the first computers, like the ENIAC in the 1945 years on the further, you have data, memory, you have a processing unit to process, And you have output. Input, treatment of information, output. The von Neumann model. Was von Neumann a German, by the way?
Yeah. Hmm? Hungarian.
Hungarian, okay. Well, this model has been used for quite a while, but they realized one problem. With this model, they were able to make a computer play better chess than a human being, because chess is enough of a rational purpose. But for reason to function, it has something it needs to do. It has to simplify a reality. Reason cannot handle complex data. Reason needs to shrink the data to be able to function. Which means reason, people who function only with reason are extremely easy to manipulate. Did you know that? You just need to feed them with the data which leads to your conclusion. It's extremely simple. You just make sure you give them enough of the data going in your direction, and they will be happy to process them, and they will be clever because they will think they know what should be done. But since reason has to shrink the data, it's not able to handle the complexity of reality. There is no way. You want to input all the parameters? You're not created for that. You're created to be able to handle, on this objective side, only a few elements. 2, 3, 4, 5, 7 at best. So when they began to do things that a human being wants to do, and I was working for 2 years in artificial intelligence, they began to realize that the most complex things in the brain are not the rational tasks. It's the relational tasks. For instance, I worked on character recognition. 2 years of my life were spent to help a computer recognize where is the postal address in a complex mail. 2 years. And I could increase from 40% to 50%. Isn't it great? Are you impressed? It's complex. Face recognition, it was a work of more than 20 years. Now we have phones which have begun to mimic human intelligence. Not only the objective knowledge, but the relational knowledge. How does it do it? They do it the back and forth. Imperfect, taking the risks and checking with you back and forth. Which means the phones take risks. Take risks. Did you know that? When you speak, it takes the risk to present to you the best understanding of what you said with the option that you can correct in a feedback loop. And today these phones have become so addictive because they give us a feel of a human relationship. Do you know that? We don't speak about the addictions concerning that, but I tell you, they have understood this one, how you balance the two, how you mimic with character recognition, voice recognition, interaction, and you almost feel it's a living being which is there. It's crazy. And we are just at the beginning. Let me be honest. We'll begin to see stuff which will challenge us big time because the computers have begun to learn to tap into this. What happened is science has begun to realize that experimentation leads to principles which lead back. The purpose is experimentation again, but an experimentation enlightened by the principles. Okay? That's what happens with your phones. And they correct always more through the interaction. So a phone taps into relational knowledge big time, smartphones, okay? With the help of objective knowledge. Objective knowledge, think of the principles. Now let's look at Christianity. We have tended to teach people 50 years ago, most of our theological training was on the epistles of Paul. You know why? Because it's where we got principles. That's real stuff. The stories of Jesus in the time of Calvin, if you want to understand, Calvin is a man of his time, very clever, but the scriptures are messy. You don't have one story of Jesus, you have four stories of Jesus. What a crazy idea. If your purpose is to get principles on absolute control, one story is plenty enough. Four stories makes you realize that the perfection is not in the stories. The perfection is in Jesus. And that the stories lead you to Jesus. And that Jesus is the center of the Gospels. But in his time, Calvin will create what they call in these days a harmony of the Gospels. There, beginning, we are in the 16th century, second part of the 16th century with Calvin, they begin to be big times into this objective knowledge, also in Christianity. Slowly, Christianity begins to recover the importance of narratives. We have to go to the 1980s. Kent Brower was one of the first doing narrative theology on the Gospel of Mark, for instance. That was new. Robert Altman for the Old Testament. That was brand new to realize stories are powerful and cannot be reduced to principles. There is more. So what happens is we begin to realize that systematic theology or integrative theology, principle, Christian principles are very useful. Understand me, I'm not telling you trash your Bible and walk with Jesus without anything. That would be stupid. So much wealth in the teachings of scriptures and in the teachings of our theologians. The only question is for what purpose? The heart of all that is here, encounters. The purpose of our life is not to be super clever and able to describe the 16 articles of faith backward and forward with the citations and with the very spiritual articulation. The purpose of our life is to learn to love God and love our neighbor, to walk with God in this life so that we are prepared to be in the kingdom. That's relational knowledge, from start to finish. The principles are just a help. So good scientists focus on experimentation, not trying to show principles as perfect. When I was finishing my master in science in Paris, one of our teachers said, it was in the 1980s, 1993, I'm getting old one step at a time. He was telling us, be careful. In 5 years, all what you have learned will be rubbish. You need to continue to learn and to experiment, to realize that science is an in-process journey. In Christianity, let us not be stuck with a view of science which is old of 100 years. It's old stuff, but in general in Christianity, we are not the first to move because we tend to attach our importance to tradition. And it's important, but we have to identify imperfections in our culture which have impacted the way we live and teach the Christian faith. Are the epistles of Paul important? Extremely important. But the stories of scriptures are important also. And as we continue together, remember, when you do a scientific experiment, can you be sure of the result? When people ask, can I be sure? You know they are stuck here. You want to experiment God and be sure it's the voice of God? Then learn from Moses that you have to take risks. Oh yes, but crazy risks? No. This will help you to sift through and avoid the most stupid things. But in the end, you will still need to check through your walk that it was God who spoke to you. Don't throw out systematic theology. It's extremely important. But don't put the focus on it. 40 years ago, who were the teachers in the German faculty who were the most honored? The ones teaching preaching or the ones teaching theology? That was theology. Because the emphasis was there. Practical theology was messy. It's like in science, mathematics was considered beautiful, and then mathematicians tended to disrespect physicians, who tended to disrespect chemists, who tended to disrespect biologists, and I don't even speak to you of social sciences. That's way down the ladder. Yes, because the value was how much control do you get? And as soon as you would integrate relational knowledge, that was getting messy. Risks were needed. So that was the foundational elements I wanted to present to you to understand. Encounters with God are not an option. They are the foundation of the Christian faith from the time of Adam to the time of John the Evangelist. Let's not be deceived. That's where we have to head. Is it easy to walk with God, sense His guidance, so that the Spirit teaches us everything? Oh my, no, it's not easy. It's a whole journey of a whole lifetime. Will you learn all the skills so that you have a perfect intimacy with Jesus after 2 days? Probably not. My hope is we challenge you in a gracious way to say, we have to get better at this. We have to walk, we have to learn together, and as we journey together, God will help us to find a balance where our Wesleyan theology leads to a Wesleyan way of prayer. And Wesley is not perfect, but he had a good insight of the importance of the Holy Spirit. So I will finish here for today. Jan will continue, and we will move toward more practical things, because I hope now you have a clear idea why we speak of intimacy, why it's important, why we cannot discard it as a foundational element of the Christian life. Thank you.